G'day, folks. Talk to Jeff Amato, a proud Wiradjuri Aboriginal man from Mount Wellington, New South Wales. Man, having a young with this fella, polarising stuff. He's been through the fire and flames. And what I mean by that is going through drugs, addiction, incarceration, the stuff that goes on the inside, and then coming out and getting amongst his culture, holding on to that, latching onto that, you know, really finding out what that means to him and being able to spread that as a motivational speaker with his program, more cultural rehabs, less jails. And I echo that. Awesome yarn. And want to thank our sponsors, Permabil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here. And they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, let's get into it.
Keep rolling with Jake Briggs.
Oh, yeah.
Actions.
Yeah, that's it. Action, guys.
Righto. Rolling.
Rolling, eh, brother?
Jeff and Matto, thanks for coming down, brother, and having a yarn.
No worries, brother. Thanks for inviting me.
Mate. Just want to kick it off with your mob, where you're from,
yeah,
and what that means, my brother.
No worries, brother. Yeah, my name's Jeff Amato, and I'm a proud Wiradjuri man from Wellington, New South Wales. You know, I grew up there all my life. my nan, pop, mum, you know, I grew up on the Nenama Mission out there, so the Nenama Mission means a lot to me as well. You know, I grew up there on the Nenama Mission myself as a kid, and yeah, loved it, brother, loved it.
So you're a motivational speaker.
Yeah, brother. I never thought I'd be where I am today, but yeah, I'm privileged enough to travel Australia and inspire people in the struggle, you know.
And talking about the struggle, so let's go into, and so with the name of what you do is more cultural rehabs, less jails, yeah?
Yeah, that's right, brother. Yeah. Yep. I've got a Facebook page, you know, Jeff Amato, more cultural rehabs, less jails. You know, and I'm fortunate enough to live that lifestyle. You know, there's a meaning behind that Facebook page. It's not just a name of anything. It's a Facebook page on how I healed as from my dark days, from addiction, alcoholism, and you know, in and out of the systems. You know, so. I know it works, you know. I know it works for a lot of our people being locked away in incarceration and jail's not working, you know. So that's the reason I've got out there and advertising, you know, what works for a lot of us is if we want to close the gap in that sector, is what we need is a lot more cultural rehabs and less jails.
That's right, and that's what I promote too, brother, is, you know, less incarcerate. You know, more rehabilitate. And your experience, like, can you give us a bit of a narrative of, you know, where you was as a young fella and some of the struggles that you've gone through and where it led to going into certain jails and just some of the experience there and to where that led to where you might have had that sense and that feeling of, you know, I don't just want to be here anymore. There's more purpose.
Mm.
So can you take us through that line of from where it started and when you had that idea and where it is today, brother?
Yeah, well, like I say, me growing up in Wellington, out on the Nenama Mission, you know, I spent a lot of my childhood years, you know, and culture was a part of my life. My nan, my pop, they read 13 of their own children on the Nenama Mission, and that's not including their grandchildren as well. And what I could remember growing up on out on the Nenama Mission was culture was in our life. There was a lot of fishing happening. There was a lot of my pop was probably one of the best rabbiters to grow up on the Nenama Mission. You know, he took us grandkids rabbiting, he took us fishing, and what I could remember, culture was pretty alive in our lives, you know, and I was lucky enough to go to school on the Nenema Mission, you know, so.
Yeah, you're deep entrenched in culture, that's for sure.
Yeah, 100%, 100%, brother, and I was fortunate, like I say, I think to myself I was pretty lucky back then, you know. We didn't have much, you know, growing up, material things, but what we had was probably the three most important things in Indigenous life, and that's culture, that's plenty of love, and never went without a feed, you know. So, yeah, that's how it was as a kid that I can remember, until we moved into town, you know, and that's where sort of things started going pear-shaped in that sense.
Yeah, so when it started going pear-shaped, so that's moving into town out Wellow Way, yeah, Wellington or?
Yeah, moving into Wellington. Nenema Mission, you know, is probably about 10 or 15 k's out of Wellington.
Yeah.
And what I can remember as a 7, 8, 9 year old was living in Wellington and starting to go to primary school in town, you know, and that's where stuff sort of turning for the worse, you know.
Yeah. Was it just like being in town, like just not having that connection to culture like what you had beforehand, or just what the atmosphere was like in Wellington at the time? And just, you know, because you're growing up, you're a young fella, and you know, if you're running sort of with the wrong crowd, or, you know, because it's a whole mix of things, you know, if it's loss of culture, if it's, you know, running in the wrong crowd, if it's drugs also come involved, and if it's lack of not doing certain thing, if you don't have enough to motivate within in town or in the area, if there's nothing to do, and where you're away from, you're not fishing, you're not doing the ravening, you're not living off the land.
Yep.
And then it's a whole different atmosphere, and trying to work that out as a young fella and just growing up.
Yeah, well, like I say, what I can remember when, you know, as a kid, when I started going to primary school in Wellington, Centrelink started coming a part of our life. You know, and once we started, Mum started getting Centrelink, Nan and Pop started receiving Centrelink, we started coming welfare dependent, you know, and what we started doing with the money that I can remember as a kid was alcohol and gambling started coming into our life. you know, Mum, she done her best for us kids. You know, she was a single parent. She looked after us kids by herself and done her best. But what I started noticing going to primary school was a lot of pubs started coming into our life. You know, I was always down the pub watching Nan, Pop, Mum, aunties, uncles, feed the poker machines, drinking a lot. It was starting to come home in the house now, and it was normal for me to wake up, you know, 2 or 3 days, 4 days out of the week at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, hearing a lot of domestic violence and, you know, partying all night, a lot of country music playing, a lot of crying and a lot of screaming, a lot of laughing. And you hear that stuff time after time and you start to believe it's normal, you know, and I can only speak for myself, and I'm sure a lot of other people can relate, is you see that stuff day in, day out, and you just think it's normal, you know. And I started growing up, you know, taking that stuff to school with me, hearing a lot of domestic violence at home, going and trying to sit at school and learn, it was impossible.
Because you wouldn't have had those thoughts in the back of your head, and just would you have general anxiety kicking in, and maybe the teachers don't recognise what's going on with you as a young Aboriginal person, and what goes on at home, and just really how that affects you, and just trying to be a young fella and operate at school. Because that, what I've seen in the past, is where teachers don't know how to handle some of our mob when they're young, and it, you know, that's a bad black kid syndrome, just put them at the back of the class. And then, you know, they're not learning and nothing's getting picked up. And then that's when certain kids, boys and girls, start acting out, not getting attention, not learning. And that's also because of the stuff going on at home, obviously, but and depending on the areas that they're living in. Yeah, it's a tough one, yeah?
Yeah, for sure. And it's you've hit the nail right on the head there, brother, you know. And going to school and trying to concentrate and you had all the other kids at the front of the classroom that was, you know, what was switched on and when you're going to school and you heard domestic violence the night before, what I'd done, I can look back on my life now and say I was a kid that sat up the back of the classroom and you hit the nail right on the head when you just said your bit and what I'd done was I sat up the back of the classroom and I fantasised. And I could hear a lot of the hands going up on the chalkboard and the blackboard, the teacher doing this, but I couldn't hear none of it, if that made sense. And because what I was doing, I was sitting up the back of the classroom fantasising. And when I say fantasising, I was starting to become traumatised as a young kid. You know, what I heard last night, you know, I heard the mob, you know, my auntie's being bashed around, you know, my nana pop rowing and screaming. And when you're at school and you're trying to concentrate and all you can think about it was what happened last night or what's going to happen tonight when I go home. And that's exactly what I'd done. And I was a kid that the teacher said, well, he doesn't want to learn. He doesn't want to listen. Set him down to the principal's office. And I was a kid that was forever at the front of the principal's office because I didn't want to listen, because I didn't want to learn. But little did I know, there was so much stuff going on. There was more than just me not wanting to listen.
So much more. Like, how are you supposed to, like, compute through the day when you got this stuff going on at home and then just trying to concentrate on in class? And even if you do listen, you know, because you would it be right to say you'd be thinking, like, you're fantasising and you know what's happened the night before, but then you're thinking forward, what's going to happen tonight, tomorrow, next week, you know, if that stuff's just going to keep rolling on.
And that's what had happened. Like at school, it's for me, maybe roughly year two to year six is where I struggled and started veering to spire downhill, you know. And I was a kid because the gambling started coming into the household, the drinking, you know. We get, you know, the mob would get paid Thursday and we'll write for a feed Thursday, Friday, maybe Saturday. But what's going to go on when they're blowing all the money and we're going to school Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday with no lunch money, you know? And what that done as a kid, I started sitting next to kids at school that had the nice lunchbox, you know? They had the nice big salad sandwiches and the poppers and the cakes and it looked really good. And when you're sitting next to them kids with no lunch money or no lunch at all, starving, not a good feeling, you know, it's not a good feeling at all. And what that caused on top of it, traumatised, I believe, was I started becoming a kid with low self-esteem. You know, I was thinking, I'm not as good as these kids next to me, you know. You know, they've got the nice clothes, they've got the nice lunchbox, they're getting picked up, you know, from Dad. And like I said, Mum was, she struggled herself being a single parent, and when you're seeing a lot of other kids getting picked up and taken a trainer by Dad, and it plays a big impact, you know, and that's what sort of it caused as a young kid as well, is low self-esteem on top of traumatised, you know.
Yeah, and just feeling like you're stuck in the middle because you've got this going on at home and you got this going on at school and being stuck in the middle and that traumatised effect, like, how would you act out? Would that just keep piling up and then would stuff eventually explode, or how were you dealing with it?
I was a kid that kept it all in, you know, and it was only a matter of time before it was going to come out sideways. It had to come out some way, and I kept it in till about year six. You know, I still haven't experimented with alcohol, I still haven't experimented with drugs, because I was turned off it as a young kid. You know, you see it and I thought, I don't want to be like that. You know, I don't want I don't want to be the one that's drinking, you know, all hours of the night and bashing my aunties around or bashing mum around. Or I don't want to be that person. And I still got to year six and still haven't touched a drop of alcohol, year five, year six. And it was only a matter of time, you know, because I kept it in. I didn't speak about it. I was ashamed to talk about it. We weren't allowed to speak about it.
Yeah, because that's that cultural side of things too, when, like, that feel of shame when you get shamed out and just how that really keeps building up and just bottling it up and just not talking to family or not talking to, like, teachers or anybody else, and that just keeps internalising. And like you said, it's got to pop out somewhere, yeah?
Yeah, and that's what happened. You know, I didn't want to talk about my mum, you know, that's my mum. I didn't want to talk about what happened at home. That's my family, and it bottled up and bottled up, and I was only pretty much a ticking time bomb waiting to happen. And I got to year six. I only just made it to year six, and that's where I looked at my older cousins and my uncles and. This stuff started looking appealing, you know. I seen them laugh and I seen them having fun, and I got to year seven, and that's when end of year six, start of year seven, and that's where I started sort of experimenting with alcohol.
Yeah, that's pretty young, boy. Yeah.
And oh yeah, it was young, and I could still remember the feeling it gave me, you know, the feeling it gave me. It made me feel warm. You know, there was a hole in my heart that alcohol filled, you know, and it made me feel, it gave me confidence. You know, something I didn't have all the way through school, and I could approach people. Once I started drinking, I could make the boys laugh. I could make the older boys, I'd do what they say. If they say, go and pinch a bottle of whiskey, I'd go and do it. And this is what alcohol started doing, and I thought, well, this is what's been missing.
Yeah, so not having that confidence, that low self-esteem, and once you're, like you're saying, you're feeling warm, you're feeling that internal glow, and where that could bring up that confidence to jump into certain situations, and that's only going to be like, internally, you're going to be like, man, oh, more of that stuff. I want to get in. I'm doing this with it. They're starting to accept me now. I'm this person. You know, you're sort of looking at who you want to be. Is that fair to say, bro?
That was 100%. That's how I felt. You know, I'm starting to fit in somewhere. You know, because I don't fit in with the kids at school. You know, because these kids, they're coming to school before the bell. You know, they're in class. They're going to footy training, they're getting picked up, they've got all this, and I didn't fit in that world, you know, because of my stuff that was going on. I didn't fit into that society, and the society that I fitted into was the one that where, you know, you put that alcohol in your body and you start to feel warm, but that only happens until you fall asleep and you wake up and the problems are still there.
And with the problem still there, and so you're drinking as a young fella, so where did some of the trouble start really kicking in? Like after the drinking and getting thrown into certain situations?
Yep, that's right. I was year seven, year eight, I was a kid that was forever wagging. You know, I was never at school because I thought they're all down the river wagging. You know, back home... you know, we all pitch in our lunch money or what money we've got, and we go down the river, and that's where we sit all day, and that's what happened. And I started year seven, year eight, only just, but now in year eight I'm starting to thieve. I'm starting to do a bit of crime, not much, you know, it's just knocking a bottle off here, you know, a little bit of smashing a window here. And that's where it started going south, and I made it. I made it for halfway through year eight, And the principal said, Jeff, we can't have you doing this. Because what I was doing, I was down the river, and if the boys weren't there, I'd go to school and I'd walk in and out of school at 10:30 in the morning and do what I want and walk back out. And the principal sort of had enough of it and said, we can't have you here, you know. We've got to try something else because school's not working for you. So my career at school ended, you know, halfway through year eight, and that's where it sort of started veering south quick.
Going south quick.
Mm.
So you started getting into this petty crime stuff, smashing windows, thieving bottles. What did that eventuate to, and like where did the law start getting involved?
Because what that started doing was I was surrounding myself with people that were doing it. And this lifestyle now is it's all happened from stemming back from a kid, from a kid in year two, year three, from the stuff that was going on at home. I still haven't dealt with it. I still haven't spoke about it. I still holding it in here, and now I'm, you know, 15, 16, and I'm starting to hang around pretty much men that are doing a lot heavier crime. They're doing drugs now, you know, they're not doing alcohol. These men were doing, they were doing jail. I still haven't seen the inside of the law or inside of the jail system yet. But now I'm starting to smoke marijuana. The alcohol wasn't doing it for me no more. You know, at first off, it gave me that feeling of warmth. It filled that hole. It gave me confidence. But now I'm starting to hang around men that are doing heavier drugs, which is heroin, cocaine, speed, marijuana, and as a kid, that's where it all started taking off to another level. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was all floating around out Willow Way, eh? Back then, yeah.
Yeah. Back then. The primary drug was heroin. There wasn't no ice around then. It was speed. They used to call it goey, you know, that kind of stuff. There was no, but the primary poison back then in that community was heroin.
And is that the path that you ended up going with, brother, like with some of the heroin coming into town and seeing some of the other mob getting into it? Like, was that the path that it went?
Well, that's what I mean. I love the saying, you know, it's hard to soar like an eagle when you're surrounded by turkeys, you know, and I see that saying and I can relate to it so much, you know, and one of my old mentors said to me, they said, son, you surround yourself with, you know, and I didn't know what that meant. And 15, 16, now I'm starting to... I'm not getting that confidence no more off the marijuana. You know, that's starting to wear off. I'm chasing that feeling again, what I first got, and I couldn't catch it. I couldn't catch it through the alcohol. I couldn't catch it through the marijuana. And
that's what it's all about, the chase, eh?
That's what it's about, brother. You're just chasing and you're chasing. You never catch that first feeling, you know. That first feeling of using the alcohol, you'll never catch that feeling again. And I tried to chase it, and I'm doing a lot more crime. You know, a lot more crime, and I was smoking too much. I couldn't support me smoking habit. But I was, the blokes who I was surrounding myself with were doing jail, and they were on heroin, and I could see the effect it was giving them. And I was like, I want that effect. You know, I wanna feel like that. I wanna look like that. It looks appealing. You know, and because that's what the alcohol first done to me. Exactly what that feeling that looks like. And I started smoking heroin at the age of 16 and a bit, you know, and I hated heroin as well growing up, you know. I seen what it done, you know, to me mob. I seen what it done to me cousins and what they were doing, robbing their mum, robbing dad, robbing the mob to get on the heroin. And I thought, that's an evil drug, you know. I don't ever want to touch that kind of drug. And at the age of 16, nearly 17, I fell into that lifestyle. You know, as much as I didn't want to, not proud to say it, but I started smoking heroin at the age of 16.
Yeah. You know, that's tough. That's very tough. So you're hitting that at the age of 16, And when you're hitting those hard drugs, especially when you don't have the dollars to keep up the habit, and then you're on that chase, you need more. And you need money for to keep getting that habit ongoing. And then that's when it leads to more crime and, you know, stealing off the mob and all that. So is that where that led to with runs in with the law or...?
Yeah, 100%. That's exactly where it led to, brother, you know. And I was 16, halfway through 16 or 17, that's where, you know, it upped the ante again with my crime. And because once I started smoking heroin, I thought I found the love of my life. You know, I thought this is what's been missing. And to think back, to go back to when I started drinking alcohol, I thought exact the same thing. And but now the heroin, that's given me the confidence again. You know, I can do anything. I feel warm. I feel fuzzy. I'm glowing. You know, I started smoking so much of it. I started doing so much crime. But now, nearly turning 17, I'm getting introduced to the law. You know, the cops know me now in town. They're pulling me up. You know, they're asking me questions. I'm starting to do breaking in-ins now. I'm starting to hang with men that are doing time in jail. And it comes 17, and I can remember.
And what was the police and their attitudes like with a lot of the mob around town, and especially with you youngsters?
Oh, well, like I say, there was back home. You know, and I never thought I'd say it, but there were some police officers that did care. You know, you get them police officers in them small communities that do want to help, you know, and I'm not going to sit here and tar them all with the same brush, because I used to do youth programs with police officers that wanted nothing but the best, and they'd give me their heads up and say, mate, you've got to pull your head in, you know, they're talking and this kind of stuff. But some of them are really, really sarcastic and arrogant and just love seeing us youth in the struggle as well, you know. And but I come 17 and again, the smoking wasn't doing it. You know, I had to smoke. I had to do too much crime. I had to smoke too much of it. And as you said yourself, it cost money. It cost money, money I couldn't afford. Money, the crime wasn't giving me the satisfaction because I was smoking too much of it. And turned 18, just about before I turned 18, I was surrounding myself with that circle still that was injecting and doing jail. And you know, it was only a matter of time before I put my arm out and said, well, let me try it.
Yeah, yep. Because that's, you know, what you hear, the next gradual step, brother, is, you know, going from the smoking, and then it's, you know, because you want that chase. So, you know, the needle comes into play then. And so once that come into play and you starting to get into jail, like what was the experience like when you first went into jail, and what jail did you first get thrown into? Was it one close to home or in Sydney or what?
No, well, it was one in Sydney, and like I say, before I turned 18, I injected for the first time, and I spiraled downhill so quick. Before I turned 19, I was homeless heroin addict. You know, that's how quick it spiraled downhill. And still, fortunate enough, I wasn't introduced to a jail till I was about 23, you know, 22, 23. But now, at the age of 19, I was a homeless heroin addict. And I'm doctor shopping now, and
still in Wellington, or
still in Wellington. Yep. Still at home, and but I was before I turned 23, I became a poly user. And for those that don't know what a poly user is you'll use anything to get a result. You know, you'll use anything to stop the phenomenal craving in your body. You use anything to stop the head. It doesn't matter if it's methadone, prescribed medication, if it's speed, if it's heroin, if it's cocaine, drinking out or whatever. you know, a lot of addicts these days have got a primary purpose of what they love, what their poison is. And but before I turned 23, I became a poly user where I use anything, and that's where jail become a part of my life.
That's huge, like hitting it from all angles, and you know, because you'd been in it for so long from a young age, and what you're talking about with the levels,
yep,
where it started.
Yep, exactly.
And then getting harder, and then all of a sudden, poly user, it's anything just to get that feeling.
Get a result.
Just to fill in that warm bit of your heart, eh?
Exactly, and that's where I've become. And I found a partner at the age of 23 too, where I had my first child, and you know, she fell pregnant, and she said, you know, we're having a child. This is my ex-partner. We're having a child. You got 9 months to sort your life out, you know, because I can't have our child around the way you're sitting, you know. I'd go for 3 days and I'd come home and I'd sit on the lounge on the night and you know, just smoke a marijuana in the house and doing what I wanted, spending the pension, spending my pay. And she said, I don't want our kid growing up around this, you know. And I said, well, it's, yeah, fine. When baby comes, I'll stop, you know. And I thought it was that easy. But little did I know, by now, at the age of 23, I had so much baggage. You know, I've had so much trauma, so much low self-esteem. I had a lot of baggage I haven't dealt with, and I thought giving up drugs was just that easy. And when baby came, I sat in the labour room that night, you know, straight. I stayed straight for about 10 hours. And, you know, when baby came, I cut the umbilical cord and I gave her her first breath. I heard her cry, and then I took off.
Yeah.
You know, I...
Because what were you feeling, brother? Like,
that's what I started feeling, and that's what I didn't like. You know, I started, you know, getting this feeling. I was withdrawing. I didn't know what was going on.
Just overwhelmed.
Overwhelmed. Huh? I was stir crazy. You know, I was sitting in a labour room and hearing doctors and seeing nurses, and the head was manic, and it was like a spring. It was all over the shop, and once I cut the umbilical cord, I took off. And so what I'm saying is, you know, addiction is so powerful. I chose a lifestyle of addiction over my own flesh and blood.
Yeah. It's what it, you know, not what it just does to the body, but, you know, what it does upstairs as well, and with the whole mental health aspect. And if you, especially if it's poly-using and it's hitting stuff left, right and centre, and if you're trying to suppress certain feelings and, like, yeah, might be trying to bury certain things, but really it's making matters worse.
Oh, it is. It is. And that's where it started. My mental health started attacking me sideways as well now, on top of my addiction that was so ripe. You know, my mental illness was hitting me from left, right and centre as well. And you know, and at that point of time, I had to get on a program, you know, a methadone program. But my intention was to get on it for a month or two, and then wean myself off all this, you know, was poison.
Was this outside rehab or in jail or what?
This was before. This is, you know, I'd do a bit of stint in jail, and I'd get out, and I'd jump on the program, and that's how it was. And I got out and I thought, I'll get on the methadone program. I'm going to try to, you know, for a month or two to wean me off all these drugs. And I can remember I got stuck on it for about 6 or 7 years.
It's a long time.
It was. And
that stuff's just eating you. But like that sort of drug. But what's it, especially when you're on it for a long time like that, you know, the effects that stuff can have on your body still. But what, like having it for that period of time, like what were you feeling? Was that enough or?
No, it still wasn't enough. Like, what I used it for, my at the start was to just use it to wean myself off, but then I jumped on it and I used it for somewhere to fall in case I didn't have the drugs the next day. Like if I did crime that night or whatever, and if I didn't get a good earn, I had the methadone to fall back on. I had the methadone to fall back on, and that's how I used it. I used it in the wrong way, and yeah, it became a thing where I couldn't kick it. You know, after 7 or 8 years on it, in and out of jail, and I got introduced to a rehabilitation centre in Sydney. It was a methadone to abstinence program because it came to a point of time where I couldn't. I thought my life was pretty stable, you know, but little did I know I couldn't go without the methadone. I was still doctor shopping. I was still using speed. I was still stealing.
Can you explain for people that don't know out there just with doctor shopping?
And the doctor shopping is I'd go to different doctors in different towns, you know, and if I went to Dubbo and got Valiums off that doctor, I'd go to Wellington, I'd get Serapax off that doctor, I'd go to Molong, I'd get, you know, Mogadon off that doctor, and so I was forever, you know, I'd sell them, I'd be taking them, and so whatever I could get my hands on, I started turn into this person where I didn't even know myself. By now, my culture meant nothing to me. As today, I'm a proud Indigenous man. By this time, I knew no purpose of what my culture meant to me, what Aboriginal people had to go through in this country, you know, 240 years ago, and all that stuff. It meant nothing to me, you know. So
what was the feeling like inside the cells and inside the jails? Because you know, it's overrepresentation of our mob inside jail for our brothers and our sisters out there.
Yep.
Like, there's mob in every jail.
Yep.
All over the shop, all over Australia. Yeah. So what is the culture like in jail and the interactions between mob and all the other different cultures that are within there and just the interactions? Like, how does that feel out, brother?
Yeah, well, The last bit of jail I'd done was when I was about 28, you know, and that's where I started noticing things in there that it's not normal, you know. I started seeing brothers collecting their methadone, coming back into the yard, you know, spewing it into a sock, squeezing the sock, and brothers using it. You know, this is the stuff. I'm starting to see brothers line up 20 and 30 deep to use one syringe. I'm starting to see brothers, you know, turn against brothers over drugs that are getting around in the system. I'm starting to see stuff that I thought, this stuff, it's not right. You know, when I started seeing this stuff, I could remember laying in my cell and my mental health started becoming stronger and stronger, attacking me sideways, and I thought, I can't do this no more. My addiction was ripe, my mental health was ripe, my ex-partner left me, I had no visits, they sent me 500 k's away from a mob. And when you start seeing that stuff, I can remember them shutting the door every day at 2:30 in the afternoon, and when you're laying in a jail cell with no TV, you know, because I did it tough. I had no one sending me money for a TV buy-ups. If you can live a comfortable, or you can make it a bit comfortable if you've got someone looking after you from the outside, you know, but if you're in there with nothing and you're laying in a cell from 2:30 in the afternoon with no TV, no blankets, just the old itchy blankets where you wouldn't let your dog lay on these days, and sometimes not just for one day but 3 or 4 days lockdown, you know, I can remember the last time I did that, I thought, I can't do this no more.
And before we jump into that, before you go, I can't do this anymore, when you're the correctional staff in there, how would they go about treating mob? Like if you've been at different jails, like you want to see different interactions with different staff and how they treat Aboriginal people, like how is that?
There needs to be a lot more programs in there. You know, there needs to be a lot more cultural programs in there for Indigenous people. There needs to be a lot more, just programs.
Well, you've seen it firsthand, lived it, breathed it.
Yeah, exactly. And I can remember sitting in there, and all I do all day, every day, is walking up and down a yard, you know, walking back and forth. There was no programs. There was no rehabilitation programs. All that was on offer every day was chasing drugs, and you know. So if there was a lot more programs, a lot more counselling, a lot more trauma counselling, I think it'd make it a little bit better. I'm not going to say a lot better, because I love the term saying, you know, us as Aboriginal people, we're spiritually connected to this country. We need culture in our lifestyle. We can't heal in jails.
True that, my brother. And talking about, so what I've been involved in is Koori Court systems down in Sydney. So you got the one at Surry Hills, and you got the one out at Parramatta for the Children's Court, and where it's all culturally sensitive approach, and where you have elders involved, and now with the adults, and where you got like the circle sentencing. So is there, I haven't been involved in that, seen that much, but how is that look of around the state and the different jail systems that you know of, brother? So with that going, because with circle sentencing, that's a lot of elders and mob involved there, yeah, but, and is that working?
Yeah, what I've heard of it, I haven't sort of witnessed it firsthand, you know, and I want to start getting to it and being involved with it a little bit more. And but what I'm hearing is it's getting better results than it is, you know, and I'll call a spade, the white man way, you know. But when it comes to the that kind of sentencing, I think there needs to be more follow-ups than just, they've got to be, you know, bailed to a cultural place, rehab, where they can deal with their trauma. They've got to be dealing with their grief. They've got to be dealing with, if I think that's going to work if there's a stage 2 to it.
You've knocked it on the head there. So, like, that's where I think where the stage 1 would be, like having these cultural set programs on the inside, but where they transition, if it's going through the Koori Court, circle sentencing, like culturally appropriate court systems, where that transitions to the outside, you said it, brother, stage 2. And that's where, you know, that just keeps going. There are certain programs out here and there, but where there needs to be a bit more funding or more money thrown into these, but
There's not enough, brother.
I know, it just said it on your face. Like, there's not enough money going into these programs that are in stage 2 or even stage 1.
If there was a quarter amount of the money that's going into jails, into programs, into stage 2s, into stage 3s, we're going to get a lot better result. We're going to close the gap for incarcerations for Indigenous people a lot more. You know, and I can only speak on the statistics and you know, a place I went through, the Glen Rehabilitation Centre, you know, they, I think they said they get up to about 105 applications a month.
105? And is that just Aboriginal?
No, that's not Indigenous, but yeah, a lot of it's Indigenous, you know, the half of it's Indigenous people, I'm pretty sure, or maybe a bit higher. And the most they can take is 10.
Yeah, well, that's massive.
You know what I mean? Like, and that just goes to show there, you know, they get all that people applying 105, 106 a month.
And so personally, you've gone through the Glen, yeah, through that rehabilitation process, yeah.
Oh yeah, and I was going to come to that part of my life, and the last time I got out of jail was just over 11 years ago now, and I had a probation parole. I never thought I'd say this to the day, but I had a probation parole officer that cared, you know, and she said, you know, I was still on parole and I was still giving dirty urine samples and...
Yeah.
And as much as I couldn't go... I had no more jail left in me. And as much as I couldn't go back to jail, I couldn't stop using.
Yeah.
I couldn't stop using drugs as much as I couldn't bear to lay behind a jail cell one more night. I still could not stop using.
Yeah.
you know, and she said, Jeff, I should have pulled your parole by now and you should be back in jail. She said, but it's not working. You know, there's a place on the Central Coast and it's called the Glen, and it's an Aboriginal rehab, you know, for men.
Yeah.
You're an Indigenous man, why don't you give it a shot? You know, you've got 3 months parole left, it's a 3 month program. And I thought, you know what? I'll tell her what she wants to hear, you know, and I said, okay, I'll give it a go. You know, and my intentions was to go up there and from Wellington up beyond the Central Coast. I had to step out of my comfort zone, and that's why I love the sign, you taste the fear, you know. I was full of fear, and because I was coming to a new environment I knew nothing about. Like, I was pretty comfortable back home in that bubble. I knew everything. I knew how to make a quick dollar. I knew how to survive.
Mm.
And to step out of that comfort zone and taste the fear.
Try and be comfortable in uncomfortable situations.
Exactly.
That's it, just having a taste. And if it's 10%, 20% of what you can give, that's something, because it's going to eventuate to something bigger and brighter. And, brother, to where you're sitting here today having a yarn.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I've done. And I thought all my life no one's going through what I'm going through. You know, no one could be going through this lifestyle. And I went to the Glen, and by then my right was sick as it ever was. And I can remember the first 2 weeks, you know, it was the first time I put the drugs down since I can go back to my story till I was in year six, to right up to a fully grown man. It was the first time I've ever went total abstinence, no alcohol, no drugs. And I can remember the way I felt that first 2 weeks, you know. The only way I can describe it in a nice way, or so the listeners could have a bit of understanding what an addict has to go through to get clean and sober, is my body felt like it was getting burnt with a Bunsen burner. You know, for two weeks going through
that feeling.
Going through that feeling, you know. I couldn't sleep. I was spewing in the middle of the night. I was forever running to the toilet, you know. I couldn't eat. My body was aching, you know, and that's because of all that, you know, that trauma, all that stuff as a kid, the drug and alcohol abuse, it's all hit me just at once. And the first 2 weeks, yeah, that's how it was. But, you know, the way I got through that program is I had men that walked this lifestyle before me walk beside me and say, it's going to be all right. You know, you're feeling the way you should be feeling, but it's going to get better, you know. And the way I can...
They're just pushing you through those hard spots to say you're going to get through it, you know, just keep pushing.
And they tell me their story, and they tell me what it was like for them, and it gave me that bit of spark, like maybe this doesn't last forever. You know, after 2 weeks, I started getting micro sleeps, and, you know, I started eating a little bit. And what I think the most important thing come back was I started to come back and contact my culture. You know, the only way I could sleep was I started listening to a really powerful man, you know, Guru Muyinapinyu.
Oh, yeah.
I started, there's a fireplace at the Glen.
God rest his soul,
you know, and I started, there's a fireplace at the Glen where men sit around and yarn, and I started going out to there at late hours of the night when I couldn't sleep, watching that fire. And when I slept, for the hour or two I did sleep, I started dreaming about my pop, and he was the strong Adriana that kept the family. He was the rock of the family, and I started dreaming about him, and I believe he started coming back to me. And 2 weeks led to 3 months, and after 3 months I was done, I was dusted. I could have went back home and our old mentors that walked with me said, just stay on the Central Coast. Stay up here and give it a go. You know, give it a go for at least 12 months. And that's what I done.
Yeah. 12 months?
Yeah, I stayed in rehab for 12 months. And after 3 months, there's another stage of it. And going back to, you know, what we're just talking about, we need another stage. That's exactly how it was with the Glen. There was... Stage two was transition, and transition, it means it's transitioning back in society. You know, if you go into that stage of the program, you've got to start looking for work. You've got to start giving back to the new fellas that are coming in.
Yeah.
You've got to start, you know, they want us, you're just being a taxpayer. And
that's awesome, paying it forward, you know. You've gone through that.
Mm.
You've gone through that anguish.
Yep.
That cultural belonging of where you've gone through years of, you know, abusing your body and the mind and the soul.
Mm.
And where you can give back, like what I was saying, with paying forward, and then you got these young fellas coming through, you know, you've been in their shoes.
Yep.
Can empathise there. And it's like, righto, bud, you're going to feel this pain.
Mm.
Roll with it.
Yep.
Because we're going to get through to the other side. And talking about the other side, with you coming through and with these young fellas, let's jump into a bit of that, eh?
And that's where it all started for me. You know, I started getting a fire in my belly for my people. You know, I started thinking back to how full the jail systems are in Australia with, you know, Indigenous people, my people. And I found a fire in my belly to start standing up, saying I've got a voice, I've got a story, and it needs to be heard. You know, just the statistics, because I started digging real deep about my people. You know, I didn't know nothing about they had to go through what they went through, you know, when the white men first come here. Mm. And, you know, growing up at school, I knew more about Captain Cook than I did my own people.
You don't get taught nothing about,
you know what I mean?
Mob in detail.
Exactly.
At school.
Yeah. And that's when I thought, no, there's so much missing here, you know, from a kid. What is it? And it was like, I've got to start stepping up for my people, you know. And that's what I done. And I stayed in transition. And things just happened again. You know, I worked for the first time in my life.
And how was that? Like, the feeling of working but finding, like, talking to the people, like if it's in the employee or, I mean the employer, sorry.
Yep.
And jumping into that world. And then was it a bit of anxiety kicking in there? Like,
it was.
Are they going to accept me? Like, shit, I'm just out of prison here. Like,
yep.
I'm a young black fella.
Yep.
Like, how is this outside world going to accept me?
Yep. And I was lucky enough because my first job ever, you know, I never worked in my life until I went in the second stage of the Glen at the age of 30. I never had my license. I was $22,000 in debt. I walked into the gates with two bags of clothes, plastic bags. And I worked for the first time with people that targeted youth, you know, and that's where my journey started to fall into this lifestyle. Is like, this is the sort of work I want to be. I want to be working with people that live the same life as me, that I've lived the same life as. And I can remember,
because that's so important, having people like yourself, brothers and sisters of lived experience. Yeah, you know what's up. You know best.
Mm.
You know what these youngsters are going through, and that's where it all starts. It's where it started with you, with the trauma as a youngster.
Mm.
And then you got certain people like yourself that can jump in, interject, and just go, hey, youngster,
mm.
there's another path to this life.
Yep. And that's where the connection is. That's where the trust comes in. That's where the younger ones say, oh, well, maybe he does know what I'm going through, you know, maybe he can help me, you know, because if kids are pretty, they're pretty sensitive, they're pretty switched on, they know if someone hasn't sort of lived that lifestyle, there's no connection there, there's no trust, there's no, like, I don't want to listen to this person. And that's the way I got through it, is because I heard men come up to me and say, listen, I know what you're going through. You know, because I lived it. This is my life, and this is what I did, and this is what I'd done. And trust me, things get better. And you know, I'm still, you know, 10 years later. You know, nearly 10 years clean and sober, and travel all around Australia telling my story and into jails. You know, and letting people know what works for us Indigenous people. you know, and not just Indigenous people, you know, what works for non-Indigenous people as well, you know. The jail system's not working. They're overpopulated. They're filled up. They're building them everywhere to try to bed people.
See, that's what drives me nuts. That, like, all the different angles to that with incarceration, like where I've been involved in. You got just in New South Wales alone, right? So with all the mob that's coming through, 73% have disability, which is huge. And there's... And then you got 40% down in Victoria that are coming through. They got a lot. That 40% are acquired brain injuries, ABIs, you know, and that's where they don't have a lot of people in place to help people with these disabilities or not come through. And then you got other cases like in WA, NT, indefinite detention, like where I've been involved with. And shout out to Belinda Mason. I was involved with an unfinished business. Like, I was one of over 20 individuals with disability, a part of a portrait exhibition that went all around the world and whatnot. But one fella, Marlon Noble, and he's just one of many that went through indefinite detention. So he went 10 years without a formal conviction.
Yep.
No nothing. Just got thrown in. No trial. What? 10 years. And this is happening over and over again. And it's where people with, where they can't deal with some mob with disability, so they just throw them in jail. No conviction, no nothing. Just let them sit there. Years roll on.
Yep.
And look at the impact that that does to mob. Mentally and physically and culturally, when you're getting just pulled, you know, for the wrong reasons, or there might be certain situations, but still, like, getting thrown in without a conviction
and
for all a decade.
All that's doing is he's adding trauma to the trauma.
Spot on, brother.
You know, we've, I believe still today that we're still, our generation are cop traumatised from our elders, from our past, that have been, it's been passed down to us still to today. And that's why, you know, things got to stop now. Things have got to, you know, they're starting to get a lot of, you know, a lot of stuff happening with, you know, they're starting to turn the wheel a little bit and listening to the Indigenous people.
That's good.
But there's still a long way to go, you know, and that's why I do what I do, you know. If we want to close the gap for Indigenous people, you know, what we need is a cultural place rehab to start. Because what I needed for me to start with my trauma, my grief loss, my financial, all this kind of stuff, number one priority was I had to know who I was as a person. You know, what did, you know, being Indigenous mean to me? You know, why are you so proud to be an Indigenous? So number one was culture. I had to know who I was as a proud Indigenous man, and that filters down to trauma, to figuring out my trauma ties, my grief loss, you know, all my drug and alcohol abuse, and it filters down to sex, et cetera, et cetera, you know. But number one for me was I had to be introduced to a cultural-based rehab where number one priority was culture, you know, because I was lost for so long. Growing up, you know, and the Nenema Mission being a big part of my life, to where I veered off. So from there to right up to age of 28, 29, I was so disconnected from my culture, from who I was. You know, I was a lost boy. So I had to start that as my number one priority. And that's why I say what we need in this country is more cultural rehabs and less jails. It costs $620 million to build a jail, you know, and they're just building one up in Grafton at the moment.
Yeah, it's not private, is it? It's probably a bloody private jail.
Big chance, yeah, I'm pretty sure it is.
Because that makes me sick too.
Oh.
You know, they're making money off keeping people inside and it's just cycling.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
And they're not dealing with, because for me, why the system didn't work for me, okay? This is why it didn't work for me. Because I'll use a veteran, you know, you lock a dog up, a wild dog up for so long in a cage, you let him out, he's going to go feral. He's going to go wild, he's going to go angry, you know, and that's how it is and I can speak for me, you know, being locked away with no programs, no identity, no cultural loss, away from mob, no visits, no nothing. You know, I'm told when to sleep. You know, I'm told when I can eat. I'm told when I can piss. I'm told when I can shit. I'm told when I can have a shower. You know, and that's all good, but it comes to the big day where we're released, you know, and many times I stepped outside of the gate and I thought, well, what do I do now? You know, I've got $400 in my pocket from Centrelink. I've got no license. I've got no ID. No one's picking me up. What do I do? I freeze, you know, because I'm not told what to do in the real world, and that's where we need the stages for stage two. We need to start transitioning people into society. And I'm not saying we go into jail and we start transitioning rapists and murderers and all this kind of stuff. If, you know, like a C2 class O should be, there should be a lot more programs for a C2 classification inmate. You know, if he's allowed to, for me in Bathurst jail when I was in X-Wing, we was walking outside the gate, walking up to our work every day and then walking back. You know, like, you know, the C2 class O, I think a lot of it, we need more programs. We need to have, we start having their license for when they're released. We need to start having qualifications to get a job when they're released. We need to start
on the inside, yeah. They need to start doing this, yeah.
That's exactly right. So when we get out, we're a chance. You know, we're a bit of a chance. But you get out and you've got none of this, you got $400 in your pocket, mate, I'll tell you what, it's not easy.
Nah. And the cultural system's getting back to country, yeah? Like what
that's what I
done.
Mean. A lot of us are sent off country to be locked away and we're released on another country we know nothing about. Oh, I'll knock a car off, I'll get home, you know, or I'll go and get on first and then I'll start. And it's just a merry-go-round. You know, it doesn't stop. And
well, I'm blown away by you were talking about the Glen before, where they only got X amount of beds, and then you've got this waiting list of hundreds.
Mm.
Like, if this is just continuing, like, wouldn't you think state, federal government would get behind this, throw some money? What's going on?
Mate, well they've just been privileged to receive.
You're living proof that it works. You've gone through the system.
It works. And I'm not going to sit here and say it's going to work for everyone that goes in there, because it's not. But I'm telling you now,
you need to try, though.
Because what's in place is not working, you know. And the life I live today is unreal, you know. I've went back to TAFE for the first time last year, and since I was expelled from year eight, you know, and I studied my community cert for in community service. The year before that, I was awarded National Dreamtime Community Person of the Year, you know, for the work I do travelling around Australia and at the Dreamtime Awards.
Solid, brother.
You know, the things that I've accumulated, you know, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander TAFE Student of the Year, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social and Emotional Wellbeing Student of the Year. And for me to go back to TAFE and try to re-spark the brain, it was the hardest thing I've had to do, you know. But I
We keep learning, brother.
And I took on advice from people that walked this life before me and said, listen, this will happen if you do this, because this is what I done. And I took that stuff on board from the lived experience. And you know, I'm privileged enough to say I run my own company now and travel Australia, which is, I'm blessed, you know.
Yeah, and tell us about the company and just how that works out, where you are,
yep,
what you're doing, like, yeah, where you're booked in, like how people can get a hold of you.
Yep. Well,
and what and everything that's involved with it, brother.
Yeah, no worries. Well, I'm speaking to people that have got influence on locking our people up. So that's I'm speaking to a lot of probation parole officers. I'm speaking to, not long ago in Wodonga, I spoke to a lot of, you know, a room full of detectives and police officers, probation parole officers. This year I spoke to all New South Wales local court magistrates. I spoke to New South Wales district court magistrates, you You know, just telling them what's really going on behind the jail walls. You know, let's call a spade, and let's be honest now on what's going on behind them walls. You know, and just the importance of Indigenous people to heal is the number one priority is culture. You know, we need culture back in our life to heal. Because like I say, we're spiritually connected to this country. You know, we need culture in our life to heal.
100%, because there's been so many people cut off, and that's people that's gone through the jail system or just people out living their lives where when you're looking at the stolen generation, where you're looking at where a lot of links are being cut off and where we're trying to build collectively around the country, trying to build up and what that means as a collective voice.
Yes.
Culture,
that's what I mean. So important for Indigenous people, you know. So what I do is I do my workshops around on how I healed, you know, how I healed as an Indigenous man, how I broke the lifestyle of, you know, drug, alcohol, incarceration and the stigma around mental health, you know. I've come to realise that I can't do this on my own. You know, I've come to realise that it's okay to put my hand up and ask for help because I couldn't move forward without it. I needed it to move forward. I couldn't do it on my own. You know, I tried, and the only place that led me was back to jail. Over the last 2.5 years, I've travelled over 80,000 k's of Australia, and that's to as far as Cherbourg, out to Wilkenya, Brisbane, Melbourne, all over Australia, and just to tell people that, you know, this is the way I healed, and this is the way we're going to move forward as Indigenous people. This is the only way we can heal. You know, we can't heal in jail, and that's what I say. Our people, it's overpopulated with our people. You know, the statistics are saying Indigenous people are right up there. Higher than any other country in their, higher than any other culture in their own country, and that's with everything, incarceration. You know, as Indigenous people, we're the poorest culture in our own country. You know, and the statistics just go on and on. Indigenous people are higher than any other culture in their own country, which is so sad.
Need change.
That's what we need, brother. You know,
we need more people like you out there spreading the word, but. We need, what's more importantly here is that it's recognition of it.
Exactly.
Of these, you know, if it's state, federal, government, like, sort it out. Like, we're living and breathing it, seeing it. Like you said, the statistics that are there. We need change. Need to close the gap. We need to keep grinding, tasting the fear, dip the toes in.
Exactly.
We need
brother.
To keep pushing the bar.
Yep.
Let's try and wind the doors closed. Like, it's going to be hard to completely close the gap, but, hey, we need more people in there giving it a crack.
Exactly, brother, 100%.
And is there a message that you want to leave to the viewers and the listeners?
Yep.
That's, you know, from the youngsters to the elders, to everybody else in between, to our people, and not just the mob, everybody out there. Yeah. Everybody,
you know, just before I leave, you know, today I want to thank you, brother. You know, you're a massive inspiration to me. You know, I've watched your YouTube clips when I was going for my Search for and Community Service, you know, and I want to say thank you very much for bringing me on your podcast. You know, it was good to sit here and yarn today, and to any other viewers, you know, I love the saying is, come on, just listen. You know, we're spiritually connected to this country. You know, we can't heal in jails. We need more cultural rehabs and less jails, you know. And all we want to be as Indigenous people is be treated like every other Australian.
That's right. Equality.
Yeah. We don't want poor me's or this and that.
No.
We don't want all that kind of stuff. You know, personally, all we want to do is be treated like every other Australian in our own country. It's not much to ask.
Beautiful, brother.
Thank you very much, my brother.
Love your work. And just before we go, social media, if people want to get in contact with you, Throw it out in the atmosphere. It's important stuff.
Yeah, well, get on my page, you know, Jeff Amato, more cultural rehabs, less jails. And if you think you could use my lived experience presentation to benefit your community, just flick me an inbox and I can get an information pack to you and hopefully come to your community.
Righto. Love your work.
No worries, brother. Thank you very much.
Get behind him.
And go the Bunnies.
Go the Dragons.
Thanks, brother.
Thanks, brother. Beautiful. What a polarising topic, eh? And just great to see how and what culture means to him as a proud Wiradjuri Aboriginal man and how he's been able to manifest that and produce it into a program and where it can spread that to the masses. And hopefully that touches a lot of people out there. Loved it. And if you did like it, hit that subscribe button. Be much appreciated. And if you want to get in contact with me, you can get me via Instagram at Street Rolling Cheetah, or one word via email, streetrollingcheetah@gmail.com. Or there's also the Facebook page, Keep Bowling with Jake Briggs. And want to thank our sponsors, Permabil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here. And they got great assistive tech also. So righto, see you on the next one.